Thank you, Dr. Polk. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon, or maybe it's still morning, I don't know. It's afternoon in Hartford, so that's all I know. I think this is a very important topic. I generally start out by asking how many are doing PET, but I get a little discouraged. Well, I'll ask you anyway. How many of you are doing cardiac PET studies? So there are a few of you. 10 years ago, when I would ask how many of you are doing gait aspect imaging, almost no one would raise their hands. My point is that technologies evolve and develop, and I think that PET is one that all of us need to pay attention to. Certainly, I think is an important part of the future of nuclear cardiology. This is the growth of PET over the last 10 or so years. You can see a pretty substantial increase in the number of generators being used. Now, as Dr. Dabala went through partially this morning, most laboratories who do PET use rubidium as their radiopharmaceutical. There are some laboratories using ammonia. The ammonia images and the rubidium images are relatively similar. What I will be showing you today are rubidium images. The techniques and the interpretation are very, very similar. What I thought I would also do is kind of develop a scorecard. Since most of you are not doing PET, I'm primarily here to show you images, but I thought we'd run through why it is that there's so much interest in this modality. It's been around for years. So here's my scorecard. This is just my opinion, but whatever it counts for. What about diagnostic accuracy? Which wins, PET or SPECT? Overall, PET wins hands down, probably by a pretty large percentage, both in terms of an improvement in sensitivity and specificity. So that's one reason to think about putting this in your laboratory. How about image quality? Again, higher KEV, much better image quality. The worst PET study is equal, in my mind, to probably your best SPECT study. So a big difference in image quality. How about ease of tests? I'll go through the protocol. I think Dr. Dabala showed you a little of that this morning as well. Half an hour compared to 3.5 to 4 hours. Easier on the patient, easier on technologists. Radiation exposure. Surprisingly, you would think with a higher energy level that the radiation exposure, in fact, would be very high. But because of the short half-life, the exposure, as calculated by some very sophisticated measures, is probably in the 4 to 6 millisievert range. So that's actually below that of stress-only imaging for SPECT. How about additional information? Blood flow, calcium, TID, wall motion. Generally speaking, most of the advancements in these areas are towards PET. I'll show you a couple examples from our laboratory. Calcium can be done with a SPECT CT camera, so that's the CT side of thing. But I think blood flow, and you'll see in these meetings, is really coming to the forefront and will be a very important addition for PET. How about ability to exercise? For now, SPECT wins in this argument. Because of the short half-life of rubidium, only pharmacologic stress can be done. There is a phase 3 trial of a F-18 agent, which is being conducted now. F-18 has a half-life of 110 minutes, so you will be able to exercise. Furthermore, with ammonia, protocols are being developed to also be able to do exercise. So right now, SPECT wins that argument on a day-to-day basis. How about downstream utilization? Well, if we're trying to economize medical care, PET, again, the data show utilization of cath and revascularization is less with PET because of the higher diagnostic accuracy than with SPECT. Claustrophobia, probably this is an issue in which SPECT would win because a lot of the camera systems are PET CT, and as a result of that, there are claustrophobic issues. We certainly see that in our laboratory. Payment is also favorable for PET. Now, this is also a moving target, but so far that appears to be remaining true. And finally, approval for study. probably SPECT, although some of the RBMs are having a great input on that. My point would be this is still an emerging technology, and as payers get comfortable with it, they are more inclined to approve PET imaging. One of my colleagues, in fact, is doing a study which is supported by an insurance company because they really want to know which is better, PET or SPECT. So there, we have their attention now, and I think you'll see those things changing in the next few years. Well, interpretation of PET, if we're saying it's higher image quality, should actually be easier. And you know what? It actually is. The reason is that the higher accuracy is because of somewhat of image quality. Attenuation artifact is generally not something you have to deal with PET, and you've spent hours with Dr. DePuy going over how to adjudicate attenuation artifact. That basically goes away. That's pretty huge. Why is it? One is higher energy, but also attenuation correction is done on every PET study. So let me just say that again. Attenuation correction is done on every PET study, and I think both of those factors is very important in eliminating, for the most part, attenuation artifact and providing a higher diagnostic accuracy. And for you as the reader, calling something truly normal or abnormal now becomes easier. However, there are other technical issues that you need to be aware of, and I can't go through all of that today. I'm going to show you a couple examples. So we traded attenuation artifact for some other things, and you need to be aware of that. A lot of it is within your control, so let me just mention those. Breathing artifact during CT acquisition can really interfere with the ability to use attenuation correction. Misregistration, which is really movement between the CT acquisition and the PET, or sometimes if it's a line source between the PET attenuation correction and PET acquisition. So that's called misregistration. Motion artifact with PET does occur. Now the acquisition is 7 minutes, so that's not that hard for a patient to endure. In fact, I would argue that most of us are doing 15 minutes for SPECT studies, and so motion artifact is less common in PET than it is with SPECT, but it's a little more difficult to recognize. I think I have an example of that. Attenuation artifact is not totally eliminated, so you need to at least be aware that that does occur. And finally, blood pooling, either from extravasation of the injection or acquiring the data too early. So these are things that that really become challenging with PET, but if you know what you're looking for, pretty easy to identify. Okay, so let's look at some images. This is a patient who presented with non-anginal chest pain, could not exercise, underwent a rest stress dipyramidal PET study, and as I said, she's 44. So the initial images on top is the stress, so it's stress and rest, so there's four sets of images, so it's stress, rest, short axis views. So we have five choices, and they are, this represents anterior ischemia in the LAD territory, the second is anterior ischemia in the diagonal territory, third is anterior ischemia in the circumflex territory. Fourth is attenuation artifact. This is a female patient. And finally, need more information. So these are your five choices. And we're going to leave this up and then give you a chance to use the audience response system. How are we doing? Okay, so, okay. All right, so people said, everybody answered one or the other. Most of you said B, which is anterior ischemia in the diagonal territory. Several of you, 32% exactly, said E, need more information. So what's up with that? Well, let's look at this a little more carefully. Turns out that this patient had misregistration. And as you can see, this is the stress PET CT overlay. And the sine qua non of misregistration, this line right here is the CT, and the perfusion, the PET study, is actually into the lung field. And when that occurs, misregistration artifact is obvious. So if you redo this, if you actually have the software to fix this, this now becomes a completely normal study. Essentially, what one does is move the PET study into the attenuation map and resolve the issue. So if you're not aware that this is going on, this is one of the reasons why a patient would go to the cath lab and have no coronary disease. So one of the ways to prevent this is for every study that you do, go through some sort of a QC measure. This is a software company that provides the ability to look at rotating images, all of the CT images, and then over on the right, the overlay between the PET and the attenuation images using both the coronal and transaxial view. So if you use this to start off with your interpretation, then you will not have a problem with misregistration because you will identify it before you even start to look at the image. So that was kind of unfair, particularly because you've not done anything. But a lot of you identified that there are problems. Okay. Next is a 72-year-old man who presented with a cerebellar infarct. His ECG showed some inverted T-waves and had mildly elevated biomarkers, obviously has several risk factors. So in this case, before going to the cath lab, the physician wanted to identify whether there was ischemia and how severe the ischemia was. So this is a stress-rest rubidium. This is now labeled, showing the short axis, vertical long axis, and horizontal long axis views. So the stress is on top, rest is on the bottom. So just take a few minutes, a few seconds, how's that? Look at this study, and I don't believe I have wall motion for this. So what do you think? Here's the possibilities. Fixed anterior, fixed infraseptal defects. Reversible anterior, fixed infralateral, no TID. Is this complicated or what? Sorry. I think it was 3 in the morning when I was doing this. Okay. Or how about a reversible anterior, reversible inferior infralateral, or finally, number 4, partially reversible anterior, reversible infralateral, and TID. So these are your 4 choices. If you want to go back, now they gave you the choices. Here they are. Now this, by the way, this is the image quality that we expect in a PET laboratory. This is what we see on a daily basis. So I'm not showing you our best images. This is fairly routine and fairly standard. Okay, what happened? Can we use your audience response systems? Probably forgot the answers, didn't you? Aha. Okay, so 42% of you said C and 53% said D. So 3 is reversible anterior, reversible infralateral, and 4 is partial reversible anterior, reversible infralateral, and TID. Well, there is, in fact, TID. You can see it pretty nicely in the short axis views. So 3 would be eliminated. The anterior looks pretty reversible. The inferior, there's a slight residual defect, though I guess the anterior is partially reversible. The inferior is reversible. Point is, pretty identifiable transient ischemic cavity dilation. I'll get to that in just a moment. The second is that this patient has two-vessel ischemia. And one of the differences between PET and SPECT is the ability to identify multivessel disease upon cardiac catheterization. So we read this study similar. There's TID, reversible anterior, reversible inferior infralateral, And in fact, I don't have it, but the ejection fraction fell with stress, an indication of poor prognosis, and Dr. Dorbala went through some of her data as well. So the question is, does this patient have coronary disease? Yes. The second question is, what would you predict on cardiac catheterization? So let's think about that for a moment, infralateral, anterior. So disease in the LAD, CIRC, and RCAs, it's three-vessel ischemia. The patient's got TID, so maybe it's that. The second is disease in the LAD and the right coronary. Is there disease in the LAD and the circumflex, or is this disease in the circumflex only? So these are the four choices. Let's again move to the audience response system. So one is three-vessel, two is two-vessel RCA, three is three-vessel or two-vessel circumflex. And most of you said C. Some of you said disease in all three vessels. Turns out that the LAD was occluded, fills by collaterals. There was disease in the circumflex, but the RCA showed no significant lesions. So we do see transient ischemic cavity dilation with PET. However, there are very few studies that have shown that this actually is better identifying multivessel disease. And I think the reason is that PET is so good in itself at identifying, and it's probably not a marker of more severe disease. We have been going through a study of our own of around 300 patients, and do not find that TID adds much other than increasing your diagnostic confidence that, in fact, there is disease. But we see TID with both 1, 2, and 3-vessel disease. So one of the things to keep in mind when you're thinking about PET versus SPECT is this ability to identify multivessel disease. Dr. Dorbala showed you a little data from a study by Bateman and colleagues in which they evaluated separate patients who underwent SPECT and PET, had the same spectrum of disease at catheterization. And an important part of that study was the ability to identify multivessel ischemia. Our own experience in our laboratory is 40% of the time when we say there's single vessel disease, the patient actually has more severe disease. So I think SPECT, one of the limitations is, yes, you can identify coronary disease, but you're less able to identify those patients who have more severe disease, and an important advantage between PET and SPECT. Okay, next is a 53-year-old male with left-sided chest pain. This patient had drug-eluting stent to his right coronary about 3 months previously. He had residual disease in the circumflex artery, which was never addressed, and had minimal disease in the left anterior descending artery. He apparently was compliant with all of his medications. So this patient, there's a couple of questions. One is, this chest pain, is it really related to ischemia before you go to the cath lab? And the second is there disease in one vessel or perhaps in two vessels? And this is the stress and rest study of this patient. So we're using the same format, stress on top, rest on the bottom. So take a look at this. I believe I have wall motion, and on the left is the stress wall motion, on the right is the rest wall motion. So take a look at particularly the inferior wall. Okay, so everybody have enough time to see this? So the question is this reversible single vessel ischemia with TID? Is this reversible multivessel ischemia and a reversible wall motion abnormality in the RCA? Third is reversible single vessel ischemia and a reversible wall motion abnormality. And finally, a fixed infralateral and a reversible infraseptal perfusion abnormality. So those are your four choices. Okay, so 66% of you answered 3, which is reversible single vessel ischemia with TID and a reversible wall motion abnormality. How many answered 2? Can we go back to that? 19% of you said 2, which is multivessel ischemia. So let's go through this again. What you see is a pretty obvious inferior infraseptal perfusion abnormality. There's also TID, which again is important in confirming that the patient does have coronary disease, but I'm not so sure if that's going to help us in the determination of multivessel disease. So that's pretty clear, and that's very reversible. There's a more subtle perfusion abnormality in the inferior lateral region, which is right here, and you can see that actually all the way from the apex to the mid and basal portion, and that also is reversible. So that's a little more subtle. And for us SPECT readers, you may pass that off as not being significant. So one of the differences between PET and SPECT is that because we've virtually eliminated attenuation artifact, then you can be a little tighter in your interpretation, and you know, you have to develop a different set point. But something that is abnormal on PET is more obvious than it is on SPECT because of the removal of attenuation artifact and also the higher image quality. So for this reason, this patient has both by the PET study has disease in the circumflex artery as well as the right coronary artery. So it makes you wonder, was he really taking his medication or not? But what we're trying to use this for is to identify what direction the physician wants to go in, particularly at cardiac catheterization, because they already knew that he had some circumflex disease. Now you're showing that there's ischemia in that territory. So this is a good example of a reversible wall motion abnormality. We see this much more commonly with rubidium PET than we do with SPECT. And the reason is this. This is a protocol that we use. This is a 25-minute protocol. You can see we start with a resting rubidium study. And while the patient is under the camera, initiate pharmacologic stress. And at about 7 to 9 minutes, inject radiopharmaceutical in the form of the second rubidium injection and begin the acquisition within 2 minutes. Now, this 2-minute period, which is in red right here, is important because that allows blood pooling to disappear. If you start an acquisition too fast, what that means is that you'll have a lot of blood in the ventricular cavity, making the study extremely difficult to interpret. But the difference between PET and SPECT is this is during active hyperemia, particularly if you're using dipyrenamal. The active phase of dipyrenamal, we think, lasts for probably about 15 minutes. So the hyperemic phase is still there while you're acquiring the data. In studies comparing PET and SPECT, the incidence of reversible wall motion abnormalities is significantly higher for this reason. Remember, with SPECT, you're acquiring the images 45 minutes later. So you really have to have very severe ischemia with SPECT in order to see a reversible wall motion abnormality. Not particularly true with SPECT. I'm sorry, with PET. So let me go back to the gating. And it's a little hard to see on this, but if you look at the inferior wall carefully, there is a wall motion abnormality, particularly when you compare that to rest. So this would at least tell you that the most severe disease would be in the right coronary artery. But again, is what I'm trying to suggest is that there's also disease in the circumflex artery. Reversible wall motion abnormalities, Dr. Dabala did show you some of this this morning. We think this is a very useful piece of information and does carry with it some prognostic and diagnostic value. So what did we find? No symptoms, no ECG changes. At cath, he had thrombus in the right coronary and significant disease in the left circumflex and underwent revascularization of both vessels. So part of my theme this morning is both SPECT and PET are able to identify the presence of ischemia, but in terms of targeting vessels, there are data that suggests that PET is superior to SPECT in that sort of an assessment. Okay, this is a 65-year-old male with chest pain, no history of coronary disease, had a recent abnormal echocardiogram and underwent diperitimal PET imaging during which he had no symptoms or ECG changes. So these are the stress and the rest images in this patient. So there's something amiss in the stress. What you can see is that it's very blurry and very cloudy. Now that can be due to any number of reasons. So let's see if we can figure out what that is. This is a gated study. Very difficult to assess wall motion in this particular patient. So what is that? Here's the choices. Multivessel disease, misregistration, we talked about that, blood pooling, or motion on the PET stress. So one is that the guy's got severe disease, and the other three is that there's some technical limitation to this particular study. So what do you think? Answer 1 through 4. And most of you said blood pooling. Correct. Excellent. You're ready to read PET studies. So if we go back to the images, this is our quality control. What you can see is there's actually two types of blood pooling. One is if you acquire the data too soon. I mentioned that before. So for example, if you inject rubidium and you start acquiring the data within 30 seconds rather than 2 minutes, you'll see something very similar. The other possibility, when we go back and we look at, well, did we follow the rules? Yes, this patient was acquired starting at 2 minutes. Well, the other thing that can happen is if you have infiltration of the vein, then you'll have leaking throughout the entire acquisition of the data. And in fact, that's what happened. You can see there's activity. This is in the lung fields, and so the blood is still pouring in, or the radiopharmaceutical is still pouring in from the injection in the arm. So indeed, this is blood pooling. What do you do about it? The only thing you really can do is repeat the study. So this is a repeat stress study, which the image quality is not so great, but this was determined to be a completely normal study. Yeah, and now there's normal wall motion. So one of the problems with PET is that you're not able to identify things like this until you get done processing the patient. So this, in fact, was an inpatient, and we're able to redo the patient. Every once in a while, when you have a technical violation like that, the only solution is to repeat the study. Okay, this is a patient with known coronary disease, a 77-year-old female, history of several risk factors, presented with angina. She had a bypass in 1998, given the results there. She also had a prior infarction, heart failure, and a history of peripheral vascular disease. Now, in our laboratory, these are relatively complex patients. And again, you know she's got coronary disease. Since I've given you some data on the ability to identify multivessel disease, in our laboratory, this is a patient who really belongs in the PET lab. it's somewhat irrespective of the ability to exercise. In other words, we're going to identify some really complex anatomy. If you want to exercise a patient, you can do that at a separate time. So in this case, even if this patient could exercise, in her case she probably couldn't, still you have to think about diagnostic accuracy and how you want to identify complex disease. So this is the CT of this particular patient. You can see that she's got calcium, which is, again, not surprising. And these are the images that she has. So, again, stress and rest, usual format. I don't have it laid out here. So what do you think? Single vessel ischemia with no TID, single vessel ischemia with TID, two vessel ischemia with TID, or fixed inferior perfusion abnormality. So I'll just go back. Not the easiest study to read. Okay. So most of you said two vessel ischemia with TID. And again, I think I would agree with that. Part of the reason I'm showing this is that these studies, because of the higher image quality, you should be able to identify disease in more than one vessel. And clearly there's a reversible inferior perfusion abnormality, but also an anterior perfusion abnormality that is reversible. So this indeed is consistent with two-vessel ischemia. You probably will not call this on spec, but your confidence that identifying multivessel ischemia with PET is higher. It should be higher. So what we, in fact, our conclusion was transient cavity dilation, reversible anterior, reversible inferior infralateral defect. And the conclusion was both circumflex disease as well as diagonal, and at catheterization, her lima itself were patent, but she did have some disease in the diagonal as well as the obtuse marginal. So these are the kind of cases that in which you can confidently identify disease in more than one vessel, and again, our experience in correlating our PET results with catheterization is very much in favor of this over SPECT imaging, which is why we tend to use this in the more complex patients. This is an 81-year-old male patient with chest pain, had a history of coronary disease, atypical symptoms, underwent IV diperinomal SPECT imaging initially, and we identified that there was motion on both studies. They were motion corrected. These are the motion corrected images on SPECT. So this is a SPECT study. So let's see if we got, and this is a wall motion, by the way. Let's see if we got questions. Okay. The conclusion, one is this is an abnormal study. The patient needs to go to the cath lab. The second is it's inconclusive but probably normal. The third is it's inconclusive but probably a fixed defect. And the fourth is diagnostically uncertain. So what's your comfort level? 81-year-old guy, a lot of motion. What do you think? So we'll go back to that. I think we'll go back to that. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So several of you said inconclusive study, probably normal. So in this case, you would elect not to do anything else, or a lot of you said diagnostically uncertain. So we got answers on all four, so that's good. It means it's a good question, I think. Okay, well, let's see what happened. So what do we do in this particular case? We felt that because, to repeat this patient for both rest and stress spect was cruel and unusual punishment, so we decided to do a PET study. And he, in fact, was more cooperative against 7 minutes versus 15 minutes. And here's what we showed. And I don't think I have a question, but here you can clearly see that there's a reversible anterior perfusion abnormality, which you really could not appreciate on the previous study. Now, is this because there's a difference between PET and SPECT, or was that study so inconclusive that you really couldn't draw a conclusion? I would think it's probably the latter. And here's the wall motion, which is completely normal, even in the anterior wall. So he's got disease in the LAD. And went on to catheterization and to revascularization. Good for him. Okay. I think I'm just about up, but I can go through one more study. This is a 58-year-old male with atypical chest pain. And during the rest study, he was noted to be cooperative. However, administering vasodilator stress in the form of dipyridamole, he became uncooperative and there was considerable motion. Now, one of the ways that you can determine motion by PET is having the technologist look at the patient. That's quite a concept, isn't it? But it's very important that the technologist be aware that that's part of their job, is to work with the patient, and if there is motion, to make sure that we're aware of it. One of the problems with PET is when you look at rotating images, that doesn't tell you anything about motion, because this is a 360 collection, so all of the images are being collected at all times, so it isn't that the patient is moving from acquisition to acquisition. So it's a little harder to see this. So these are, I don't have the rotating images. The only thing you can say is that this looks more blurred than does this. But you can't tell motion on the rotating images because it's all 360 acquisition. Okay, so this is the stress and the rest image of this particular patient. And we have gating. So again, stress and rest gating. What are your conclusions? What is this? Misregistration, motion on stress were probably normal. Motion on stress cannot determine, or multivessel ischemia. So let's take a vote. All right, so most of you, in fact, a very high percentage, I guess you got the message. This is motion artifact. And the problem is there's normal wall motion, which is reassuring, but you really don't know whether this is a normal study or not. So I just want to go back to, let's go back to that, because this, in fact, is classic motion artifact. And you should, as a reader, should be able to identify this. What does it look like? It looks like it's a mess. So it isn't just a multivessel ischemia. The whole image is blurred, and it's blurred relatively uniformly. In SPECT imaging, what you see are classic motion artifact, contralateral perfusion abnormalities, a little distortion of the left ventricle. This is very different. So this is because it's the 360 acquisition. And as a result of that, the things that are important to identify motion, one is to have the technologist report to you when they do see motion as part of their job, as well as other personnel, including you, to make sure that the patient doesn't move. The second is that when you look at the rotating images, if you see some distortion, in other words, the image quality looks worse, then that certainly is a suggestion that this is motion artifact. And then finally, this is This is a classic example of a motion artifact. So what do you do with a patient? Bring them back. So this is a, again, you don't need to repeat the rest. We did the stress, took 15 minutes, and this was completely normal. So each one of these, with misregistration, there is software to fix that. With blood pooling, you can't do a darn thing about it. You can avoid it by making sure that your IV is patent. I mean, I showed you this example. This happened to us about 3 times in the last 6 years. And then motion during PET, which is one of the more common problems. The latter two, you're going to have to repeat the study. And as you can see here, the wall motion is also completely normal. Donna, I've got about 5 more minutes. Do you want to catch up or go through another case? Okay. I have 160 slides, so. Anyway, this is a 52-year-old male who has onset of atrial fibrillation and mild biomarkers. So at catheterization, this patient, because of the mild biomarkers and the situation, he underwent catheterization, was found to have 3-vessel disease, but also had global hypokinesis on an echocardiogram. So the concern was, is this coronary disease and a non-ischemic cardiomyopathy, which is causing the low ejection fraction? And if that were the case, revascularizing the patient would probably not affect his ventricular function. So the next question would be, can we identify ischemia in this patient with global hypokinesis? So these are your choices. You can do a low-dose dobutamine echo. Dr. Durbala gave an excellent rundown on FDG PET study. You can do a rest redistribution thallium study, or you can do a rest stress rubidium study, or you can do none. Did anybody read about Stitch during the ACC meetings? Maybe we don't need to do viability anymore. So I think we can answer these questions. Has anyone heard of Stitch, by the way? Okay. So some of you actually did say, forget about it. Some of you want to do an FDG PET study, and 30% of you want to do a rest stress rubidium. So I think part of what Dr. Durbala was saying and what I'm saying as well is that there's various components to identifying viability in patients, and identification of ischemia by either SPECT or PET is a very useful first step. What she showed you this morning was that generally speaking, FDG is done because you find something abnormal in a resting perfusion study that indicates non-viability. We're not even at that stage yet. So starting out with an FDG study would actually necessitate doing some sort of a resting perfusion study. Also remember, the patient had global hypokinesis, so he may see nothing on the rest study. So we think for those reasons, searching for ischemia would be a very good first step. This probably is not related to Stitch because the questions is really ischemic cardiomyopathy versus non-ischemic. So indeed, we did do a stress-rest rubidium study. And these are the results. I don't think I have any audience response system. So again, this is a patient who had global hypokinesis. And in fact, if you look at the resting perfusion, it's virtually normal. There's a little thinning of the inferior and infralateral wall, but really not much. What's very impressive is transient ischemic cavity dilation and virtually 3-vessel ischemia, giving the physician the correct answer. Furthermore, the patient's ejection fraction fell during the stress acquisition, an indication of multivessel ischemia as well. So in fact, the conclusion was that this was three-vessel ischemia, and the patient went on to successful bypass surgery, and his ejection fraction, in fact, recovered remarkably. So with that, I think I will close, and thank you very much for your attention.